Before we get started, I want to tell you why I keep urging you to use KISS Insights. Haven't you noticed that one of the big ideas that keeps coming up in my interviews is the need to ask your customers and users what they want instead of imagining that you know? Now, when you add a survey to your website, isn't it true that hardly anyone fills out your survey, and people who do fill it out aren't necessarily your typical users? Well, what KISS Insights does is give you surveys that are so easy to fill out that your users will actually complete them. Here's a screenshot of how I use KISS Insights. You can use it for free right now. Just go to kissinsights.com. Next thing I want to show you is the phone number at the top of dnamail.com. When you have trouble with your email and it's costing your business both money and reputation, how frustrating is it? Well, who can you call at those moments? If you use DNA Mail, you'll have a phone number you can call 24/7. DNA Mail offers complete hosted exchange, free setup, free activation, free support, and if you and your company need Google Apps, they've got you covered there too. DNAMail.com. These aren't just sponsorships, these are tools you should use. Finally, I want you to know about Shopify.com. If you already have an online store and want to increase your sales, go to Shopify.com. If you have an idea for an online store, go to Shopify.com. With Shopify, they'll set up your store in minutes. You'll get professional themes to customize your store. You'll even get a mobile app to manage your store from anywhere. Check out Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixsurgery.com, home of the ambitious upstart. You guys know what we do here. I bring an entrepreneur on to talk about how he built his business, talk about the successes along the way, talk about the failures, what he learned from it all. And the goal here is not just to entertain you, because I know that you're going to be much more entertained by cat videos on YouTube, but to educate you and send you out into the world so that you can build an incredible business and then come back to Mixsurgery and let me interview you about how you did it, and then others will learn from you. It's like, it's a circle of entrepreneurship. We all keep feeding back into the circle. Today's guest launched and sold two previous companies, and he's now launching his third. His name is Doug Campbell-John. He's the founder of MyPlay, which was sold to Bertelsmann, and MI5, which was sold to Symantec. I want to focus this interview on those two companies because those stories have a beginning, middle, and end, and I think we could learn more from stories that are completed than those that are still ongoing. But I also want to ask him about FlipTop, his latest startup. Doug, welcome to Mixsurgery.
Thanks. Happy to contribute to the circle.
Thank you. So I'm looking at your background. It hasn't all been a smooth ride. It never is really for entrepreneurs. Let me ask you this. Why be an entrepreneur?
I don't think there's anything I would rather do in the world. I think when I was growing up, my father, who had started out as an engineer and then worked for companies and then started his own businesses, said to me that if you can wake up every morning and say, wow, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this, even though as an entrepreneur sometimes you're not getting paid to do it, you're in the right job. And that's for me. You know, if I was sitting on $1 billion, I would still go start companies.
Now, I know that MyPlay got funding, MI5 was funded. Is FlipTop funded or is it coming out of your pocket?
So I've had the good fortune to sell two companies. So far I'm writing the checks for this. The idea here was to get a product to market, go get some traction, and then go out for our first round, later this year.
And actually, this business couldn't have been around that long. How old is FlipTop?
So FlipTop, we sold, Symantec acquired MI5 in April of 2009, and I incorporated FlipTop May 1st, 2009, so it didn't take a lot of time.
All right.
And we spent the summer kind of noodling around on ideas and started building a team and working in earnest last fall. Launched our first product last month and actually are doing a bit of a product pivot right now that will launch later this summer.
All right, let's go back and find out how you got into this. 98, you left Epiphany, where you worked on marketing automation, and soon after you launched with a previous Mixsurgery guest with David Pac-Man. You launched MyPlay in 99. What was MyPlay?
So MyPlay was a digital music locker service. The idea came from, this was pre-iTunes, pre-iPod. You know, the one MP3 player on the market had 64 megabytes of memory, gigantic, held about 50 songs. And I started playing around with it and realized it was really a frustrating experience. It was, you know, I had a lot of windows open. I had to download software. When I was traveling around, I couldn't really take my music collection with me because it was bigger than what would fit on this thing. And I just said, you know, I this closet actually at my house that had all my CDs and my DVDs and my games. And I said, all that stuff should just be in the cloud so I can access it wherever I go. And here we are, you know, 11 years later, and I still can open the closet and go, all that stuff should be in the cloud. But so that was the idea, starting with music. But the idea ultimately why we called it My Play as opposed to My Music was that all your media should just be sitting out in the cloud and accessible wherever you go.
All right. And the Meshuggah music industry had all these different issues. By the way, when I was researching you, I was going back in time and seeing all the different things that they were willing to do and all the things that they weren't willing to do. And man, it's nuts. There was one thing that I saw that was an ATM for music. You were supposed to go up to this thing, even though you have a computer on your desktop, you're supposed to go up to this thing, plug in your Rio MP3 player, somehow download music to that that would somehow interact with My Play, and that was okay for them to do. But for you to use your computer to get music, that was nuts. So I think just before you, MP3.com had a locker service that said basically if you have a CD, put it in your computer, we will verify that you really have the CD, and we'll have the music already up in the cloud to stream to whatever computer you happen to be on. Was that before you or after?
That was after us. It was about 6 months after us. So the original idea for FlipTop when I came up with it was just that. I said, you know, I've got this library of hundreds of CDs. They're physical tokens of ownership. I should be able to put a CD in, have, you know, it recognized and say, oh, Doug, you own these tracks and we should, you know, unlock the tracks. And David and I had calculated that to digitize the entire collection, the North American music collection, into 128 kilobit format was about 12.9 gigabytes, which at the time was a lot of storage. That was a few million dollars worth of storage, but it was, you know, achievable. Now I can go down to Fry's and buy it for a few thousand bucks. But the idea there was to put it all in, and as people put in their CD, it would unlock it. Well, one of the great things of having David as a business partner, and when I asked him to co-found the company with me, is he said, let's go talk to a few lawyers. So we did, and they quickly said, they figured that one out. You'll get sued to the tune of a couple hundred thousand dollars per track. And so we backed off from that and required our users to digitize and upload their tracks. So when a few months later, when MP3.com launched the Beam It service, as they called it, we just, you know, looked at our watches and said, okay, are they going to get sued today, tomorrow, next week? And sure enough, it was a few days, and this massive lawsuit came down from the record industry.
I see. I didn't realize you guys were first. Now, it's a crazy distinction for them to even make. The fact that I've wasted my time uploading the CD doesn't make that CD any more mine or any less mine. It's just the distinction that they were willing to make, and it seems to me that they were just looking for reasons to shut these different products down. What do you think?
I think that I used to describe it as you'd go into these large conference rooms with the record labels, and oftentimes they look like a big law room, big leather-back chairs and mahogany tables, and there was, you know, it almost felt like there was this wall of oil paintings called the Wall of Shame, and there was three frames on the wall. The first frame said radio, because whoever blew that, you know, they were giving away music. They should have been paid for radio. Who screwed that one up? Then there was one called MTV. They also screwed that one up. How do we not get a piece of that? How do we not get paid for that? And then there was this empty frame that just said internet, and no one wanted to pose for that photo. And so every time we would go into a negotiation, it was all assumed that anything that happened in digital would take away from the business that they had. And so they all priced it as a zero-sum game. So they wanted to get – they assumed that if I took a CD and put it in my computer and it unlocked tracks, I somehow was taking money out of their pocket. And so that I should – you know, we as My Play should pay them for the full value of that CD. So it's just – it's crazy behavior. And it basically took someone with the the charisma and power of a Steve Jobs to kind of break that gridlock finally and open that up.
I'm going to put this invitation out to anyone with experience in the internet, in the music business during that time, and even someone who's hopefully still around a little bit today, even if they're not fully engaged, to come in here and do an interview with me about those days. I don't want to just treat them like they're the evil industry that's out to get innovation. There's no way for me to learn that way. I want to invite them out here to just express what their point of view is, because whatever situation they're in, others are going to be in that situation in the future, and it's either going to be us, me and my audience, or we're going to be the ones going up against that industry. And I want to learn it from the inside instead of assuming the way that I did with you from the outside. I assumed that you were the second player in the industry. When you make assumptions, right, you're bound to make mistakes. So you're out in this space. You raise money at what point?
We raised money actually pretty early. So David and I got started, and this was the go-go days of the internet. It was 1999. So I think we had David and I had called a few friends some angels, some super angels at that point. We literally had $1 million in a bridge loan within 2 weeks. And so we were off to the races. We hired an engineering team out of what had then become Go, was previously InfoSeek, some folks that very sharp engineers who had been there and done it before, got some office space near the Oracle buildings, and we're going. And ultimately, over the life of the company, we raised about $26 million. Zero revenue, internet days, wonderful times.
Yeah. And the idea was to grow big, to conquer this space, and then to sell, or what was the vision?
Well, the idea was, if you looked at the record labels, they had no idea who their customers were. They said, you know, we sold 7,500 copies of the new Britney Spears album this month. I have no idea who bought those. Even the retailers, for the most part, were not keeping track in their databases of the credit card transactions and marketing that stuff back. And we felt there was a huge opportunity being lost there. I mean, I think that people had already discovered that the number one reason why that new Bruce Springsteen album, I didn't buy that new Bruce Springsteen album, even if I was a fan, was because I didn't know about it. Because I somehow missed it. I wasn't listening to the radio. Radio, if you think about it, is an incredibly inefficient way of, you know, you're hoping that somebody hears that song and hangs out for them to announce it if they do, and then remembers it by the time they get to the store. And we just thought we could take that cycle and make it a lot more compact, and also use that information to sell other goods as well. So we thought it was going to be a really great way of merchandising music and other products.
I see, okay. And how are you planning on getting your users?
So initially we did it all kind of virally and word of mouth. Then decided to accelerate that. So we're getting some good traction. We decided to accelerate that. David did a deal with America Online where they were exclusive to us for their Winamp product. And so the idea was that as people would sign up for Winamp, they'd say, hey, would you like to have a MyPlay locker? We did some co-branding and things like that. And that started driving a lot of traffic to us. And so we ended up, by the time we were acquired, we had a few million users who were on the service, who were engaged and using tracks that way. So it was both organic and some paid deals.
I see. What are the deals that you have beyond AOL? I know AOL factors in later on also.
It does, yeah. We had a several dozen of smaller, what we called sideload deals. And so the idea there was, because we had this this burden of having people trying to upload, and remember, not a lot of people had broadband at that time, so that was a big limiting factor for us as well. We wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to add music to their locker. So David and his team went out, and we would license sample tracks. You could go to MyPlay and immediately go, add this to my locker. We did sideload deals. So you could go on to various other music sites and say, oh, that's interesting, add that to my locker. And the idea was that it was kind of transferred server to server, so you didn't have to go through the upload process. So we did a number of those things, kind of affiliate programs and sideload deals, to bring traffic in as well.
How did the responsibilities break down between you and your partner, David, your co-founder?
So David was, when I called David and bounced the idea off of him, I wasn't looking for a co-founder per se. I just said, I have this wacky idea, you know more about music, what do you think? And he said, how'd you like a co-founder? I said, great, when are you moving to California? He goes, no, I just bought a house in New York. And so we had the development team in California, in Redwood City, and David and some business development and PR folks in New York. And that's roughly how the responsibilities broke down. I mean, we we very much had a great partnership, a great friendship, and a great partnership before, during, and after now still. So I did most of the product management, hiring, you know, kind of finance and operations stuff in the company and managing those folks. And David focused more on the business development and the PR and a lot of the navigating our ways through the legal minefields of the music industry.
Which were big.
Yeah, we're big.
How did you guys know each other?
We worked together at Apple years ago. So I was my first job out of college was working at Apple. I worked in the multimedia group, became the QuickTime product manager, and so I ran product management for QuickTime for the first three releases of that. David was in the system software team, and so we overlapped there and just stayed in touch.
How'd you know he would be a good co-founder?
I think the first thing about co-founders, the most important thing in general in startups and co-founders in particular, is besides, you know, high CPU, high throughput, you know, intelligence, is trust. And so David was somebody that I felt like I never really worried about being 3,000 miles away from him, because we had built up this very trusted relationship. We had kind of the shared experience at Apple, where we both knew we cared passionately about the user experience and getting that right. You know, so we quickly became kind of this old married couple that would finish each other's sentences, and that trust relationship really is what played out.
And you left Apple 7 years before you launched MyPlay. How did you know in those 7 years that he was the right person, or how did you guys finish each other's sentences or even communicate and stay in touch during those 7 years?
You know, I think we'd stay in touch socially and, you know, see each other when we'd be on either coast. You know, I didn't know from a working standpoint, you know, any startup is multiple leaps of faith. And so, you know, it was really something where David was actually still employed at the time, you know, trying to decide to jump ship for this thing. And it was just a vibe. As we started talking about the idea, as we were going back and forth, it really became clear that, you know, there was this great partnership where we would both bring something to the table.
Did you guys work on any projects together before this? Did you talk about it in a way that would let you know? You said no to that one. Did you talk about it in a way that would let you know that you were on the same page, or that you were in harmony in the way about the way you thought about business? Because there's a danger, especially if he's the guy who protected you from the record industry, that he might be too conservative, and that you might be too aggressive in this space. And unless you work together, how do you know that?
You don't. It's basically founders, you know, or oftentimes funders, or you're dating over a few, you're getting married over a few PowerPoint slides. You know, the good news is that unlike, you know, a lot of founders who come together, or founders who sometimes come together who haven't really had a working relationship before, I got to see David, you know, and see what a great product manager he was at Apple, and vice versa. And just, you know, life is too short to deal with assholes. And so, you know, there was that factor as well. Like, I'm going to have a lot of fun working with this guy. He knows something that I don't know. I know things that he doesn't know. It feels like a good marriage. But at the end of the day, it's a leap of faith, like anything else when you're starting a company.
I'm looking at the chat room here. He has a lot of fans in my audience. He did a great interview. People loved him. Another person that a lot of people in the audience loved is Chris McCaskill. Do you happen to know Chris McCaskill, who went on to found SmugMug, and he worked at Apple? I don't know if there was an overlap.
I know of him, but I don't, you know, I don't know him personally. No.
Okay. Let's see if there's any other questions from the audience. Did you raise money before you hired developers? The big money after the $1 million round?
Well, we raised $1 million, and then we started hiring developers, and we had a core team of, you know, probably four or five folks, and that was plenty to get everything started.
Okay, and then you went out for the next round.
Our first full round was a $5 million round that we did from institutional venture partners.
Any pivots? I know it's just a company that you guys ran for 2 years. It all happened really quickly, but were there any pivots back then?
There was a pivot right towards the end. So when the entire advertising industry fell apart, you know, we decided, you know, and actually I'm glad you asked this, because I think there's so much hype about pivots these days, and people automatically assume that pivots are all good pivots. And I've had both good pivots and bad pivots. And I think at my play, we actually did we still had an outcome, an acquisition, but we did the wrong pivot. I think we were all consumer guys. We built a really big consumer service. When the revenue model disappeared practically overnight for advertising and this stuff, we said, we've got to go pivot. We've got to go figure out where the money is. Obviously, it's B2B. And so what we decided to do is kind of create a black box version of MyPlay that people could plug into other things. But why I say that was the wrong pivot is it wasn't where the passion of the team was. It wasn't where the skill set of the sales team was. So it was a completely different model of how you go sell that selling cycle and all those things. And ultimately, you know, we saw things that we had the technology to go build at similar times, like ringtone services and other things that would have probably been a much better pivot for us to go into. As it were, we just ended up pivoting and having the and getting acquired a few months later, so we didn't really have to see that play out. But ultimately, I don't think that was the right pivot for us to do.
I know that at the time, a lot of companies were going B2B. Was mm-hmm. that why you made that decision? How much of an where did the influence come to go B2B?
Panic, probably, mostly.
So you're panicked. Why reach for that? Did somebody say, hey, B2B, or were you reading all the papers and seeing that everyone else was going B2B and you thought maybe we should too?
I'm sure it was a bit of both. You know, I think the real question was, who can pay us for this? And, you know, it was probably the one of my favorite quotes, I think, is a Spielberg quote, and it says the difference between a good film and a great film is how much you leave on the cutting floor. And I think that similar in startups, you know, the difference between a lot of successful outcomes are how many ideas you generate, basically, that you get to go cut away the bad ones. And because if you're just choosing from one idea, then you're going to go down that path as opposed to 100 and go, oh, this one over here is actually a better idea. And I don't think we went through that exercise and should have. I think we should have gone, really said, you know, what are all the imagine we're starting all over again. We've got a great development team. We've got these sets of technologies we can go leverage. Here's the world as it stands today. It looks a little different than it looks really different than it did 6 months ago. What can we do? And I think if I was to do it over again, I would have generated a lot more ideas for that.
More ideas, and then decided which of those you needed to pursue.
Which of those to go pursue? You know, and I think we ended up knee jerking into B2B more than saying, here's all the 50 ideas of what we could do. We're really excited, and we think that one's the best.
I see. It's always so interesting for me to do this. I think a lot of people wonder, well, why go revisit the past, or it's 2020 hindsight. How does it help? You're never going to have 2020 hindsight in the future while you're building a business. But what I found when I was in business school, well, as an undergrad taking business classes, was that those Harvard business cases were really probably the most useful part of school for me, where we thought through other people's business issues long after they'd solved them or moved on and thought about what we could do in their position. It forces you to just think about business, think about real businesses, and to put yourself in that place before you end up finding yourself in your real business in that spot. So whatever you're going through right now, you say about panic and you have to decide, I'm going to go through that at some point in the future. People who are listening to us are going to go through that. You're going to go through it. And if you practice by thinking about the past or by thinking about other people's businesses, I think it makes you a more experienced, smarter business person. All right, let's talk about...
The goal is to make new mistakes as opposed to repeat the old ones.
Let's talk about AOL. How did they factor in? Actually, I'll bring it up this way. Yahoo made an offer for you guys. I forget how much it was. Was it 100 to 200 million? I've got here in front of me.
200 million.
Yep. 200 million. It was pretty public. I asked David this. He was pretty open, but I'll ask for your perspective. Why didn't you guys accept it, and what happened there?
So we did accept it. We actually, it was an interesting roller coaster ride. So AOL, we went, you know, I think the first offer was 175. We got them to 200 million. Just to remind you how crazy the times were, we actually had investors that said it's way too cheap. You should hold out for double that. You know, we were 13 months old with zero revenue. David and I looked at each other and said, you know, let's not be crazy. Let's go do this. We went through the whole negotiation. Got actually had all the definitive agreements ready to sign. David and his wife were actually going to fly out. We're going to do a celebratory weekend with my wife and I here in California. And the Tuesday before, I get a call from Jeff Mallett, who's the president of Yahoo at the time, saying, we can't do our deal. And my heart sank from here down to well below the basement. I said, why not? And he said, well, you know, we just looked at the AOL deal, and they basically have you locked up in perpetuity. And it's like, you know, what are you talking about? And so it turned out that AOL basically, as I think David had mentioned in his interview as well, you know, it basically resorted to some very slimy and even in some cases criminal practices during that time, and we got caught in that. So David and the lawyer that we were working with had been negotiating this, and the thing that ended up tripping them up was AOL would, you know, huge documents, they'd be negotiating with you at 2 in the morning Pacific time, 5 a.m. their time, you know, lots of pressure about getting it done. But they would make changes to the document, redline, they would accept those changes, and then they would make more changes. So you're looking at a 100-plus page document that's being sent to you at 1:30 in the morning. You're not going to read the whole thing. You're just going to go take a look at what's redlined, which understandably is what David and the lawyer did, you know, accepted those changes. But one of the changes they had made was take it from a 2-year deal with a mutual option to renew to a 2-year deal and AOL's option to renew. I think they changed one word to make that happen, and we miss it. And so that ultimately became a poison pill where Yahoo said there's no way we're going to pay AOL a couple million dollars a year or whatever it was in perpetuity. This is a poison pill for us. And as we found out later, AOL knew it.
They were just trying to trip up Yahoo and trip you guys up in the process.
As we found out from an inside source later, they were trying to keep us out of the hands of Microsoft, Yahoo, and Real Networks were the three that they cared about.
I see.
But then when push came to shove, they weren't willing to step up to the plate. We went back and forth for a number of months, ultimately getting to, I think it was almost $50 million worth of the deal that were going to go to AOL to kind of buy them out of their deal. But they kept doing these things that were saying like, well, the money has to transfer simultaneously. Like, unless it lands in these accounts, like, and things that were like defied physics. And so it was clear that they were stalling. And we had actually gone to antitrust lawyers. This was as the Time Warner deal was going down. And so one strategy we considered was playing full-on chicken of saying, listen, we are going to – here's the press release. We're going to go public on Monday that we are suing you for anti-competitive practices and seeing if they would have backed down for that. But, you know, David talked me out of it because it was a scorched earth scenario. We wouldn't have been able to raise any more money. We wouldn't have been able to land the company. It was basic. And we obviously wouldn't have the resources to see the end of the lawsuit come to bear. So we didn't pursue that path.
I see. Wow. And was AOL interested in acquiring you themselves at all?
They dabbled around it, but didn't pull the trigger on it. So, you know, it was this unfortunate thing where they didn't have the, moral fortitude to say, we don't want you, we'll let you go. It's the right thing to do for these guys.
So interesting to remember the culture that they had at the time, the culture of dominance, of arrogance, and to realize that it does happen over and over with every high in the market. There's a company that's dominant that ends up pushing a little too aggressively. I'd love to do an interview with people back then to see what they were thinking inside the company. So meanwhile, it took you guys months to go through this deal, and then when it didn't happen, what happened to the business?
So we fortunately had enough money and some investors who kind of put some more money into the company that gave us a runway. In the meantime, we were doing some product transition, and we opened up dialogues with some other folks. And one of the conversations that bore fruit was with Bertelsmann, who actually had a very interesting strategy. They had invested in Napster at the time, but they also own CDNow and BMG Record Club. So between those two, they actually had the largest database of what music people have purchased on the planet. And with that, they had the idea of saying, going out and getting the licenses for streaming, so that anything you'd ever bought in the past from CD Now or the BMG Record Club would suddenly be available in your MyPlay locker. As you know, they wanted to turn Napster into kind of it's out of print, it's live, it's kind of the underground brand, which we thought was an interesting branding strategy, and pull all those things together, which actually made sense to us. And so that acquisition happened for, one less zero, and we transitioned the team into Bertelsmann. But unfortunately, because of the Napster investment they made, they got sued by all the record labels, including their own, and ended up having the entire house of cards from their digital music strategy fell apart.
Why were they able to get, or why were you guys able to get around the AOL issue with them, but you weren't able to do it before?
I think Bertelsmann and AOL had a long-standing relationship, and there was a side payout that happened, and so they were able to do that, and so AOL wasn't was willing to kind of be paid out of that deal by Bertelsmann, but not by Yahoo.
Okay, all right. What did you do after that? After the sale?
I took about a year off and decompressed. So I did a lot of traveling, spent time with my son, who was a little over a year old at the time, and got bored in that process. Was thinking about some startups back in the enterprise space, similar to Epiphany, where I worked for Steve Blank, had talked with a friend of mine, Joseph Ancinelli, and said, I've got these ideas. Some of them have some security stuff associated with them. I know you've started a security company. What do you think? And he gave me some good feedback on it, but told me what he was working on, this company called Vontu. And it was one of those, damn, it's a better idea than mine kind of moments. And so he wrote me into, starting to help them out from a product management side, and eventually it joined and ran product management and marketing for them for about 2 years. And then in the middle of that, had the bug to start something again and had the idea for what became MI5 Networks.
What was it like to go work at another company after having been an entrepreneur?
It was an interesting change. I think it was, I think a lot of entrepreneurs are not good employees, myself included. And so I think that we tend to want to do things our own ways and speak up loudly, and it's tough to plug us into a corporate culture at times. So I think that, Joseph, Vontu was a very successful company, had a great exit, $350 million acquisition by Symantec down the road. But and I feel very proud of the stuff that I was able to do, because what I'm passionate about is kind of early stage, building teams, building products. And so that part of it was fun, but not being able to play in the other spaces was frustrating at times.
All right. How'd you come up with the idea for MI5?
I was really just talking to a lot of the chief security officers that were around at the time. Kind of asking what their top problems were while we were trying to sell Vontu to them. It was pretty clear from a lot of those conversations that threats were starting to move from email to the web. I mean, 10 years ago, it was the don't click on that attachment in the email because it's going to contain a virus. And over the years, the hackers had gotten very good at filling stuff in to browser vulnerabilities and plugins and things like that. But there was a kind of a woeful lack of protection there. It was mainly folks like WebSense and Surf Control that were doing URL filtering. And so we thought, hey, maybe there's an opportunity there to build a gateway to go protect against spyware and botnets and these things that were now coming in through the web.
And this was protect companies and their employees. You were aiming at the enterprise.
Right. So the idea was, just like an enterprise would put in an email security gateway to prevent them against protect them against spam and viruses and things like that, we were the web security gateway to protect them against the bad stuff coming in through the web.
Who was in that space at the time? Who were the competitors?
So when we started, we were the first kind of anti-spyware gateway. So there was nobody that was doing that. But there were companies like WebSense and Cert Control that were doing URL filtering. So, you know, blocking you from going to porn and gambling sites and things like that. There were companies, a lot of the big security companies like Trend Micro and McAfee that had web antivirus gateways, but there wasn't really a lot of viruses that were coming through the web. So those hadn't really taken off. And furthermore, the players like that that were trying to do file inspection on the web had had architectures that didn't really scale past, you know, small businesses. So for large companies, there wasn't really a solution. I mean, if you take a second to process an email message, no one will notice. If you take a second to process a web page, everyone's screaming. So the idea was, how do you do this processing at very big scale without any custom hardware, without slowing down the web browsing experience? And we felt and found that there was an interesting niche to fill there.
Do you feel that companies like Symantec wait for entrepreneurs like you to solve that problem, figure out which entrepreneur solves it best, and then they go make a deal to buy them out instead of trying to create it themselves?
Yes.
That is their...
Yeah, I think they try from time to time and then have succeeded at times and failed at other times to do that. But in general, I think Symantec says, you know, okay, here's our product roadmap. You know, we have a gap to go fill. What's the best company to go fill that gap and then go out and acquire them?
All right, so you had the idea, you saw the opportunity. What was the first thing that you did?
So the first thing I did was kind of go looking for a co-founder. And I had somebody I'd worked with previously at Apple, Steve Ruskowski, super smart engineer. Just from raw brain power and, you know, the fact that we worked together well, I thought about him. And he was interested for a while, but ultimately had another idea that he wanted to go pursue on his own. So I was chatting with a venture capitalist I knew, Bud Colligan from Accel Ventures, and they put me in touch with a guy by the name of Ofer Deutel, who they had backed in his previous company. And, you know, I had talked to half a dozen different folks. I'd actually, you know, been out looking for a VP of engineering / co-founder. And there were folks who had better resumes on paper than Ofer. They had some security background or, you know, more kind of corporate firewall type experience. But like the relationship with David I described, Ofer and I just immediately clicked. There was this immediate trust relationship. He was from Israel. He had built a very high speed scalable networking company for telephone carriers, and we hit it off immediately. And it was one of those things that we actually incubated in the Accel offices for a while and sat in there. And again, over a few weeks, really realized we liked each other's working styles and would complement each other well, and got started from there.
Did you go to Ofer with a thesis on the solution, or did you just go to him with the problem and hope that he would come up with a way for these pages to load quickly and still be checked for viruses?
So I think the ultimate architecture Steve and I had talked about a bit, and we brainstormed, and Ofer had pulled in kind of his top, you know, cherry-picked his top three or four engineers from his last company. So we spent some time sitting around saying, you know, what are the various architectures, a proxy architecture or a real-time streaming architecture? What are the ways to go do this? So I came to it with a problem and some theses, you know, or some design goals, but it was really Ofer and his team and Steve that came up with the architecture that ended up being the winning one.
Well, what did that first version look like, and how long did it take you to come to that first version?
So we brought on the team probably in the spring of 2005 and launched the first version about a year later. And so we put a lot of time into it. The first product was just an anti-spyware gateway. And so we thought spyware is so hot, that's what people care the most about. That's what we'll focus on to begin with. That'll be our minimum viable product. Turns out the MVP thesis is a little different sometimes in enterprise than it is in consumer, which I'll talk about. But we launched that in 2006, mid-2006. Started to get some customer traction, but what we quickly kind of realized is that when you're selling enterprise products, a lot of time the question is, where is the budget going to come from? And so in the case of Vontu, for example, they were able to get budget from people who were worried about compliance and, you know, data security kinds of things that, they could pull from. There wasn't a spyware gateway budget that was there. People were spending six figures on WebSense renewal, and they were pissed off that they were spending six figures on WebSense renewal because there wasn't a lot of technology there, but they didn't feel like they had a lot of choices. But so we quickly realized, like, we had to go from a single function product to this platform. And so just like the email gateways became a platform where you could kind of plug in these software modules, we kind of went back to the drawing board, did some licenses of some technology for URL filtering and antivirus definitions and other kinds of things, and kind of re-released the product as a platform. And that's really when it started to take off.
All right, so going back, would it have made sense, instead of spending a year building out the product and launching it, to maybe go out to market with ideas for products and see if people would be willing to pay you for them if you built them?
We did, and people seemed to say, "Yep, that's a great idea." You know,
about
I think
spyware. When you were surveying them, the way that the lean startup movement says to do, they were saying, "Sure, right. We'll buy it."
Yeah, I think there's an art to customer development conversations in the lean startup methodology. I think that, you know, oftentimes when it's somebody who says, you know, I don't want to say no to a friend, or I don't want to say no to, the CEO, or I don't want to, you know, I believe you need to get out there, but I think you need to, it's kind of like doing reference checking on a client. If you do reference checking on a job candidate and you just check the references that they give you, they're all going to say great things. The question is, what tricks do you use to kind of get to the, oh yeah, but they never show up for work on time, or, you know, what's that thing that you can go dig in? And I think that in the customer development process, it's really about how do you get to those things that people, if they had an LCD on their forehead, it would read out what they were really thinking, but they may not be saying to you. And so we had a ton of people telling us, yeah, it sounds like a great idea. Spyware is a big problem for us. We're going to do stuff on the gateway. We'll probably spend on the desktop. We'll do stuff on the gateway as well. Sign us up. We want to be on the beta list. You know, and I think that the challenge is, how do you get to people saying, will you pay for this? You know, where does this rank in your priority of problems? You know, what are the sets of questions? I've in fact encouraged Steve to blog about this, of like, what are the set of customer development questions get to the meat of the problem, as opposed to getting a bunch of people saying, yep, keep me in the loop, let me know, I'll be on the beta list, you know, which are not qualifying.
Yeah, I think the guys from Kissmetrics told me that one of the things that they were doing with their surveys at Kiss Insights was creating the surveys for people, because apparently we don't know what kind of surveys to ask or what kind of surveys to put in front of our users. You said earlier that the minimum viable product is different for enterprise. How?
Well, I think that you know the risk factor of putting a physical piece of hardware in your network is much higher than going and trying on a consumer web service. So if I go on to dogs.com and enter my information and I don't like it, I just go away. It's not a big deal. For an enterprise product, though, you're saying, I'm going to go put something in your network that is not going to take down your network, is not going to open up security vulnerabilities, is going to be something that fits into the way that you manage other devices. So the bar is much higher for people to go develop a product and allow people to plug it into their network.
I see. All right. What was it about the platform? Why did the platform sell?
So I think the reality was that people want to solve the problem, you know, so they look at, you know, who's got the functionality and the pricing and all those pieces. But the platform sold when we went into these large enterprises, like take Citigroup, for example. You know, we went in Citigroup against Blue Code and FaceTime and Trend Micro and these other, you know, players that have been established for years and years and years. And we beat them in the bake-off because of the way that we had designed the platform. They could do in one of our boxes, standard PC hardware, but in one of our boxes they could do what would take them 15 or 30 of another box to do. And it wasn't just the cost and the rack space, it was the management of 30 boxes to go make that happen. And so we were able to scale in a way that no one in the space was able to scale because of the way that we had basically taken this technology for really high speed carrier switches and bringing it into an enterprise class PC.
I see. And how'd you get your customers?
A lot of direct sales. In that case, so we had a VP of sales who had been front bridge, had a small team of a couple of reps, a couple of inside folks, and it was pounding the pavement. I mean, we did a lot of webinars, we did some trade shows, we did some. In that case, there was the enterprise market. It was really about meeting. We were measuring how many meetings, face to face meetings or WebExes we'd get. And the conversion rate into beta and out of that. And so we actually at one point hired a firm that was getting paid per meeting for a qualified set of customers. And we used that as a very successful lead generation mechanism to go make sure that the sales reps had their calendar filled meeting with real prospects as opposed to doing a lot of cold calling themselves.
Oh, wow. How long was the sales cycle?
Anywhere from 3 weeks to 9 months. It was really all over the map. We had folks like Fenwick and West, a law firm that wasn't our counsel, but ended up spending six figures with us, who plugged into their network, immediately saw a bunch of stuff and cut us a PO the next week. We had deals like Citigroup that had been going on for 9 months when the acquisition went down.
So how do you adjust in a market where the sales cycle is so long? How can you change your product?
What we actually had to do is we had just started to crank up a sales team, and when we got into the market and realized that that we needed to build this broader product, we actually laid off the inside sales team. We shut down sales completely and went back to let's go build the product, let's keep the burn rate low, let's build this new thing, and then let's go get it out into the market.
So were there any big pivots after that?
No, that was that was really the right product. We kept expanding on that. I think ultimately we had it was one of the occasions where working with Gartner Group actually turned out to be a really good relationship. So we had a great analyst there, Peter Firstbrook, who was really smart, understood the space. Obviously, he liked us, so we thought he was smart. But he really, in the magic quadrant, we lucked out as well in that they kind of, as we were rolling out this new product, said, the market is shifting. It's shifting from these single function URL filters to these multi-function secure web gateways. And as a result, here's the players, and they kind of put us in the quadrant, the lower right quadrant, which meant, and furthest to that, said, so we were small, but we're the most innovative company in the space. And I'm sure when Symantec was considering who to acquire, that was a big, that certainly played a role.
Okay, I see Vontu was also sold to Symantec, I guess, the year that you launched this business. Am I right about that? No, I take that back. It was, I don't know when, but they were sold to Symantec. Was that at...
2008, I think it was.
Okay,
2007,
so a year before
2008,
you did.
Around the end of the year, in 2007, I think.
How did you connect with Symantec?
So already had some discussions with them about business partnerships, but also had a very interesting, so one of our investors in MI5 was Josh Koppelman from First Round Capital. Mm-hmm. And Josh had started a business previously with a gentleman by the name of Dave Brewson, and Dave had been the CTO of a company called Turntide that was acquired by Symantec. And so we made Dave an advisor originally, and he came in and really liked what Ofer and the team was doing with the architecture, and just he had left Symantec at that time, but still had very good connections there, and ultimately he got more and more engaged with us as the business, and we ultimately gave him a success fee. Upon, the conversations were already starting, with Symantec about saying, we want to buy you guys, we want to come in. And we said, I tell you what, Dave, we'll give you actually a success fee if Symantec acquires MI5, and, made him extra motivated to kind of play a part in that process.
I see. What was it like after you sold? What was life like?
Well, I took all of, you know, a few weeks off, but it was good. It was, you know, I'm really happy about the outcome. You know, we had a nice outcome for everybody, for the investors, the employees. I think that, you know, the two things really matter most in an exit. First is this going to be a good home for the product and the people? And so, you know, the biggest disappointment for me in the Yahoo, AOL and Bertelsmann scenario with my play, you know, the money of course was disappointing, but the bigger disappointment was that all this great work that we had done didn't live on because of what happened at Bertelsmann. And so the most important thing for me was feeling like I know 10 years from now Symantec's going to have a web security gateway. It's going to be based on our technology. You know, that product is going to live on, and there's tremendous satisfaction in all that hard work you put into it, continuing on, and also having a great place for the employees. I mean, I think Symantec is a great place for people to work. I think that they've been very supportive of the team that I've kept in touch with. So that was really important. And then obviously being able to go back to your investors and go, you know, here's the check for your investment. Thank you very much for your support is a great feeling.
Why didn't you take another year off or take some more time off before starting a new business?
I just had this idea in my head that was kind of, you know, burning, and I couldn't stay away. Well, the original idea was for FlipTop was really one of being frustrated that I couldn't get information delivered to me when I wanted from sites. So, you know, a few examples. I was doing a Craigslist search. I think I was buying a road bike at the time, and it's crazy to me that I had to keep going back to Craigslist to go. Hey, is there an update? And I said, you know, I have a computer. There should be an agent that's acting on my behalf that emails me or texts me the minute that there's a new match result. It was crazy to me that, you know, I get these newsletters that felt like banner ads to me. You know, it was kind of that, you know, I would, you know, there were sites that I wanted to know. You know, like I'm a car nut, and so my favorite website for cars is a site called AutoSpies. And it was crazy to me that I'd have to wade through this huge newsletter of all this mostly irrelevant news for me once a week or once every 2 weeks, when all I wanted to know is tell me when there's news about Audi or tell me when there's news about Tesla. And so that was the original idea for FlipTop. So we started out and built kind of a real-time alerts product. And there's actually two products. You can drag a button into your browser, and when you're on a website, say, you know, subscribe, and you can choose how and when you receive that. And we leverage RSS, but the belief here is that RSS is a great technology and a lousy user experience. So, you know, for 90% plus of the people on the web, they don't even know what that orange button means. What does RSS stand for? It's like putting SMTP next to an email icon or LDP next to a print icon. It's just stupid. So we felt like great technology. It should go into the background. You should really have an alerts button or a subscribe button. Let's go build that. And so that's what we set off to build. And we built it. But in the process of launching that, which we did at the demo conference recently and got some great press, we started saying, well, let's now add other ways to subscribe, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, SMS, and started to realize that there's going to be this really rich set of data sitting in our reports. We have this great reporting console and analytics console. And so if you could collect all of the ways that people subscribe to your website, you know, email marketing, Twitter, Facebook, RSS, YouTube, et cetera, into one place, and then also append third-party data to that, demographics and social graphic kind of data, you'd have a really rich database to do much better marketing out of. And so that's, you know, what we decided is that's an even bigger opportunity than the original one. And so while we'll still support the first product, we're now actively working and getting ready to launch later this summer the subscriber analytics product.
And the marketing would happen by the website that the user is getting updates from, or by third party.
So you're talking about for the subscriber analytics product,
yeah?
Or
actually,
so for the real time.
No, sorry, you go ahead.
So I was going to say, the idea for the real-time alerts product is that, you know, you're a large site that wants to, let's say you're a sports site and you want to give people the option to say, type in your favorite teams, and as soon as there's news published about those teams, we'll send it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all we sell to the publisher in that case, a monthly subscription, just like an email marketing service, and then they go market that out to their customers. So we don't have to market directly to their customers for that.
I see. Okay. So if I've got this on my website and people are getting updates just about bootstrapped companies that had exits, and that's all they want to know about, you come back to me and you say, do you want to market to these people who want information about bootstrap startups?
Right.
I see.
The subscriber analytics product, though, is something that we conceived in a way that you don't have to use the flip-top button to use. So even if you said, I don't want to put the alerts button on my site, or I'm not ready to put it on my site yet, I just want to start getting more information about who my subscribers are, because you may just have a Twitter handle or an email address, and you want to know, who are these people?
I see. So you're going to be able to, based on the way I'm already interacting with my users, based on the way they're already subscribing, be able to give me insight into who they are.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I know the product hasn't launched. I don't want to ask too many questions since we said up front that I wouldn't. Do you feel comfortable saying any more, or do you want to just leave it there?
No, I think depending on when this goes live, you know, we'll have a beta sign up coming on the site within a few days. So if you check back kind of later in June, there'll be a beta sign-up form. We'll be starting to put product in the hands of people in July and roll out publicly towards the end of the summer, early fall.
Okay. All right. Keep letting me know what's going on with this. I would love to just keep alerting my audience about what's going on.
Will do.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing the story. Thanks for being so open. And do you guys have a blog? Is there a place where people can go and check out what's going on with FlipTop?
Yeah, you can go to just blog.fliptop.com. It's also linked off the main site. I just did a post up there, by the way, from my experience on the Geeks on a Plane trip with Dave McClure.
Oh, you were on that?
Yeah, it was great. Highly recommend it. But just a fun story to leave your viewers with is I had the most amazing customer service experience as a result of Twitter on my flight back. So you should go check out the post, but the short version of it is we had flown out on an airline, Asiana Airlines, which I had never flown on before, and they let us use their business class lounge. And so we tweeted, thanks, you know, at Asiana for letting us use your lounge. Week later, I'm flying back, getting very attentive service from the flight attendants and going, well, it's a very friendly airport, you know, airline. As we're landing, flight attendant comes up to me and says, I'm from first class. You know, we're flying in coaches, entrepreneurs, of course, and says, I tried to think to myself, how could I give you even better service? And so I decided to write you a handwritten note. And she hands me a 3-page handwritten note, and I'm kind of going like, oh, okay, thank you. And when I opened it, it made sense. She introduced herself as the head flight attendant and said, because we were one of the first people to tweet about Asiana, that she wanted to let me know how great she thinks Twitter is, how great an airline Asiana is. And clearly, somebody at Asiana had picked up and monitored my tweet, and in that week had briefed the flight crew that we were going to be on that flight and to give us extra special care. So amazing, you know, Twitter customer service
story. Wow, who even knew that that was possible? Well, wow, to tie it right back to you being on the flight again, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing. So I wrote down the letter. It's on the blog, flip-top.com. You can see it there.
Blog.fliptop.com, and of course, check out
flip-top.com
also. For the transcribers, FLIPTOP.com. Get it right. Everyone go check out the website. Doug, thanks for doing this interview. Great to meet you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you all for watching.